Welcome to the Admin Admin Podcast, the podcast for people working in the real world of IT. If you're a sysadmin, working on a help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, a computer techie, want to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Andy, and this is the Admin Admin Podcast, episode 8. So how have things been? How was your last episode then with the other Al?
Yeah, it was really good. A bit confusing. A bit confusing. We both called Al.
Yeah.
yeah, it was good Google Hangout, have a chat about Office 365 and stuff. So, yeah.
That's right. It was all interesting stuff. I was listening to myself. It was kind of strange, really, listening to our own podcast because I don't actually listen to the podcast that often.
I always like to listen to it before it goes out live. So.
Right. Well, it's just worth a double check it then, just to make sure everything's... Well, I suppose I edit it together, don't I? So I hear it all then, so...
Yes.
But that one went pretty well, so you got that recorded okay, and then we patched it all together and out it well. So I hope everyone else listened to it and enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Some interesting stuff, especially about the telephone systems and that you were talking about. Because I know he's more of a telephone engineer, isn't he?
Yes.
Who's... you know, coming into more of the networking side as well, which is great. So that's great. So have you been up to anything else since that hangout then?
Only working a bit. I've been dealing with these, with a backup solution for one of our customers. These are quite good. These thing called HP D6000. You can put up to 70 disks in these devices. So... it's basically it's like a massive storage array, so you can just dump data on it. So we use a product called Veeam, which is a backup software, which is for virtualization. So it's not like your backup exec, where it can stream it off the tape. This is actually what it does. It actually talks with VMware, and it kind of snapshots the VM, and it basically puts an image of that VM in using Veeam. It puts an image onto whatever local storage you've got, or to like a D2D or something, and it works really well. And restoring it is quite good, because what you can do is you can either do two ways. You can restore it back into VMware by copying the files back into VMware, and then you can bring the virtual machine back up again, or you can actually bring the virtual machine directly up from the actual backup server, so it's actually hosted. So it's called like instant recovery. So you can get your machine restored within like 5-10 minutes. So there's none of this build. So there's none of this building a server, putting Windows on it, and then restoring the restoring the files back onto it. Because it's actually a snapshot and actually an image of the actual VM, it comes up and brings it up. Okay, so it brings the virtual machine up. So it's really cool. But these D6000, you can have up to 70 disks in them. And they're quite. I'll put a picture on the show notes for you. But you can like they're like a drawer, and you pull the drawer out, and you slide the discs in, and then you close up the drawers. And this one I've been working has got 4 terabyte. Each of the discs are 4 terabytes, and they're SATA. So, and we're having it in a RAID 6, because I think the limitation on RAID 5 is 12 discs, and so we need to have as many discs as we want. So basically, you can put many discs up to 70 in it. So I think with my RAID 6 I can just with 24 terabytes, I think you can just get under 70 terabytes worth of data. So it's quite amazing when you actually create a 70 terabyte disk volume to put the discs into. So that's all what I've been up to. I heard you on the on one of the other Podnut shows. It's got released
Got released yesterday. It was actually recorded sometime last week, but yeah, that went okay. I can't remember the episode, but it's currently the latest episode of on Podnuts Daily.
Yeah,
if anyone wants to go and check it out, I'll find out the episode number in a second. But yeah, that went pretty well. Just talking about whatever you know came to mind at the time, really. Oh, it's episode 393 on Podnuts Daily. So you can find that at podnuts.com/podnutsdaily.
Yeah, I was going to ask you a couple of things, which I noticed you spoke about. You were saying that you had your first computer as an Amstrad computer.
That's right, yes.
Was it a 646 you had? Or?
It was a 464.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I had a 464. My first proper computer was a 6128 with the with the 3-inch floppy drive.
This one didn't have a floppy drive. This one had a tape drive.
Yeah.
I remember the ones, they were slightly after with the floppy drive.
Yeah.
That's what first got me started on computers in the first place. You know, it was I was just amazed that there's a friend of the family that we used to go and see, and they had a computer in their own house.
Yeah.
You know, and at the time it was kind of to most people, really, it was unheard of. People just generally didn't have a computer in a house. You know, it was that time, wasn't it? And I was just amazed by this thing.
Yeah, I remember staying around a friend's house, and he had a Sinclair or something, and we were playing Frog It or whatever.
Yeah.
And the first one we ever stayed over, the first one he woke up in the morning, had to go over and put the tape in and press play.
Yeah.
So that we could have a play with it in like half an hour long. And then it'd always break halfway through, so you'd have to rewind the tape and start again from scratch. So
I've no idea, actually, how many. Well, I suppose. It was 64K kilobytes. The 464 was, of RAM. I suppose it was. There must have been ROM in there with the code in it.
Yeah.
And then there must have been some kind of RAM which was the 64K.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming that the whole tape that you loaded in must have been less than the 64K, wasn't it? For it to load into. So all that information that took half an hour to load up by pressing play on the tape was only 64 kilobytes. Seems ridiculous now, doesn't it? But that's what it was like.
Yeah, because mine was a 6128, so I had 128 in the
car.
Actually, I had a bit of a retro gaming thing the last couple of weeks. I got a downloaded emulator, and you can play all the old games. So I was playing my favourite game when I was a kid called Devil's Crown, and you had this little man. You had to go around to collect 3 bells in this in a sunken pirate ship, and I managed to get a USB little joystick gamepad from a local charity shop for £1, and I was amazed that you could just plug it in. It was a USB one. You plugged it in and the emulator picked it up, and I managed to access it. It took me about a week to complete this game, but I found a map online. Someone has given us the tips. I know it's a bit cheating, but what you can do is with the emulator, you can kind of like pause it and save it. And then you can go back to it. If you like die or something, you can just go back to your last saved game. So it's all there.
I've tried a few online emulators and some little programs you can download as well, but the ones I've tried haven't really been very good.
Yeah, you would try this. you want to go retro? Oh,
yeah, yeah.
It's just like literally you download it, then you can download these DSK files, and then you just load them in, and it's really interesting. So, and the other thing I was also saying is that you were talking about you were having a job getting someone had a laptop which had a password on it. Did you manage to crack the password at all on it?
Oh, right, okay. Well, that's taken a few turns, that job. We haven't cracked the password at all yet. it was one of those, wasn't it? It was, just in case anyone hasn't listened, it was a laptop which had TrueCrypt on it, and also the BIOS had a password on it as well. And we're trying to think of a way around to be able to reload Windows on to overwrite the encrypted disk and also get past the BIOS password so we can... The main problem was I couldn't boot from a USB pen drive with a Windows 7 image on it.
Okay.
That was a main problem because it was after a password to go into the boot menu.
Yeah.
And you couldn't get into the actual BIOS itself because that was passworded as well. Mm-hmm. And we couldn't boot up into Windows because that had a TrueCrypt password, which the guy didn't know. So, but yeah, I mean, we talked about a few of those different solutions, and Jeff come up with some good ideas as well. That his was, you know, get in touch with HP and see if there's a, you know, some kind of flash that you can do for it. Also, as well, I'm not sure if there's any like master password that, that engineers use for, you know, engineers from HP or Dell have a master password to get in.
Yeah, I mean, he's giving a quick Google, see if that laptop model and resetting the password. I mean, I don't think you're going to be able to get past it. I mean, that's what they're designed for, aren't they? So,
yeah, and I've done it a few times with BIOS passwords where I've took the battery out for a day or something, you know, and it's forgotten it. But it didn't work on this. And then my other idea was loading it onto another, loading another machine up with a similar chipset, and getting the hard drive loaded up on a different motherboard and then putting it in into that one and booting it up off that and see if that worked. But
yeah, well, I was going to recommend you do, if you can't get past it, is install Windows on any other machine. It doesn't have to be any other similar, and just work out what the SATA drivers you need for that laptop are.
Okay.
And then you can install them on that laptop, and when you, there's a special command or thing you can run, and you can take that hard drive out of it, and when you plug it into the new laptop, it will load those BIOS, it will load that laptop up on those drivers for you.
Okay.
So yeah, I've done that before when I've had to move a drive from one machine to another, which has got a completely separate hard drive. Sorry, a different separate SATA controller on it. And yeah, because I know normally do it. If you don't have it, it looks like blue screens, doesn't it?
That's right. Yeah. And you get the blue screen, it won't boot, and then we're stuck again. So
yeah.
So you've got to get that. So is it mainly the SATA drivers that cause it to blue screen?
Yes. Basically, it doesn't know how to speak to the... It will boot to a certain far, and then it doesn't know how to talk to the RAID controller or the SATA or RGE controller.
Okay, well, that makes sense, yeah. So I've got to progress with that, because I've got to talk to the guy as well and see what he wants to do, because, you know, he's got to get this thing... He's got to decide as well whether he pays me to fix all this up and get it going. You know, because if you heard the story on the other podcast, this guy got paid this laptop because the guy owed him some money and didn't have any, so he gave him the laptop instead. So kind of this is kind of like his wages for doing some job for him.
Yeah.
And if he ends up spending, you know, I don't know how much yet off the top of my head, but if he ends up spending so much with me, it's hardly worth doing. But the unfortunate bit is it's a good laptop, you see. It's an i5 laptop and relatively new. And if it didn't have all these password problems, it'd be great, you know. Be a really, really decent machine. So it's a bit of a shame, but he's got to decide whether he wants to get it fixed up or not. So I have to watch this space with that.
Anything else you've been working on? Or
there's been nothing too... there's another little... I don't know if you'd really call this a recall this week that I had, which was a guy that I know, he does... he actually does tutoring for companies, for teaching them different aspects of Excel and Word and things like that in Office. So he teaches, goes to companies and teaches the employees how to use Excel and Word and, you know, better ways, more efficient ways and stuff like that. And he asked me last week if I could go and install Office 2013 on his home machine. So mainly so he has a copy of it himself so he can use it and he can demonstrate different things that he can do on it. He does remote as well, I think. So he shows people how to do particular things. So so we went round and we basically just went to I think he bought it off Amazon, and it went to the Microsoft store from Amazon, and then it downloaded and installed, and he had Office 2013 on there and Office 2010. Now, he called me up today and he just said, Office has gone on there fine, but there's a couple of little issues. And there's a couple of issues I haven't had a chance to look up yet, but you've had some things with the newer versions of Office, haven't you, recently? So maybe you'll have some kind of idea. And one of the problems he's having is he quite often goes to Windows Explorer. So what he means by that, I think, is to My Documents, I think, basically, to open up a Word document or an Excel document. But since we've put Office 2013 on, it's when he goes to My Documents and double clicks on the Excel file, he gets an invalid Win32 operation or some error message like that. When he goes to Excel, opens Excel, goes to File, Open, finds the file, it opens up fine. So it's only when he's double clicking on it from the My Documents folder, it's coming up this invalid Win32 operation, I think it is.
All right, okay. So it might be have some corrupt file association with it. So that's what the first
I was thinking. I was thinking file association, because I've got to remember it's still got 2010 on it as well.
Oh.
And it's got Office 03 as well.
Okay.
He's got every version of Office, because he uses all three versions, you see, for his tutoring in there.
Okay. I think there might be a document out there where you have to install Office in a certain way, if I remember correctly. I can't remember which is the way you've got to do it. If you want to have multiple copies of Office on the same machine, there's a certain way you had it. Because I remember one of our old customers before is that they had like an Access 2003 database, and they had and the rest of the application they had was Office 2007, but it's the one where you don't get access with it. So if I'm correct, you had to install Access into its own little folder first, and then install Office into its own little folder. Obviously, I remember, but it might be worth a Google to have a look at that. So
yeah, I said to him on the phone and said, look, I don't know the answer off the top of my head. I'll have to look it up first, see if there's any kind of solution for that. But yeah, we'll look for that. Might have to uninstall it and then reinstall it in a different way. But to be honest, when I did a download, automatic download from the Microsoft Store, it just installed by itself.
Yeah.
You know, there was no options. There was no this, no that. That's how it went in. And now he's got these particular issues. So I'm going to go and see him next Monday, I think.
Yeah.
So I'll have to go armed with some kind of solution or some kind of ideas or methods that we can try. If it works, great. If it doesn't, then we'll have to come back for another attempt.
Yeah, I reckon it's about doing file association. If you say it's working inside it, if he goes into Word and then opens it. But
yeah, I think it's file association.
Yeah. I was going to say, also, what I've been playing about this game is I've been addicted to this game called 2048. Have you heard of this? It's like a little Android game.
No, I haven't.
I've got everyone working in the office on it. It's like you get this, basically, you have to, I'll put the links to change, but basically you get a box with 8 squares in it, okay? And every time you kind of swipe left or right, you get another new two. So you start off with two in the corner, and you swipe it and you get a two. And if you get two next to each other, you can swipe it down and it makes four. So you get four. And then obviously you swipe it again, you get a two. And you swipe it again, you get another two. And you put them together, you get four. And then you swipe it together again. You know, it's two fours you get. You swipe it together and you get eight. And then you just keep doing that. So once you've got eight, you then start again with the two. And you stop again, you get two, then you get four. And you get four and you get eight, and then you get eight, and you get two eights, you get 16. And obviously, you get 16, 32, 64, 128, until you go all the way up, do you get to 2048, and then you win the game. So it's a very addictive game to kind of work it. It's very.
I'm playing it now. I just brought it up now. you play it on the Android, do you?
Oh, I've got it on my Android phone. You just sweep with your. Yeah. I think it's probably online, but.
Yeah, if you go to 2048game.com and you use the arrows on the keyboard. I'm up to 32, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly what you are, yeah.
So I lost you for the rest of the podcast now, have I?
Yeah, you just carry on talking. I'll play this game.
Let me know the score by the end of the Yeah, that was like what happened at work. We like lost a day's worth of work playing that in the office to see who could get there first. Okay, good so stuff. I wanted to talk about tonight a couple of things. Talking about DNS and then start talking about VPNs, where and when you would use them. So start off with DNS. We were talking obviously a couple of shows ago about DNS and how it all works. If you're running a domain again and you're running in Active Directory integrated DNS, you have multiple AD servers and DNS installed on when you create, so let's say your domain name is adminadmin.local, that will get replicated between the two AD servers, so your DNS servers, that's automatically replicated. If you wanted to, what you can do is obviously everyone's DNS is pointing internally at DNS server, okay? And obviously, again, if that local server doesn't know about a domain name or whatever, it uses whatever whatever DNS servers you predefined in your DNS server to go out onto the internet. But what you can do is you can create forward lookup zones inside that DNS server. So what that can be useful is you can use it for stopping people like going to Facebook.com and stuff, because what you can do is you can create a new zone called Facebook.com and then create an A record with www. And what that means is that when someone goes to www.facebook.com, it will obviously go to your DNS server and says, right, how do I get to Facebook.com? And goes, in my local DNS server, I've got a forward lookup zone for that. And obviously looks at Facebook.com and says, what's the A record for www. And you could obviously point that to your internal intranet or something. So whenever they try to go to www.facebook.com, it gets pointed to the internal server. It's also quite good if you're working with multiple companies and you're kind of integrating the two companies together, you can do it like that. So you could say like you've got like another company, like company2.local is the AD, their AD, and you've got connected connectivity into their site. You can use that to so when they're trying to go to something like a website or an internet on that site, you could have some sort of forward lookup zone. And what you can do with a forward lookup zone, you don't have to put all the records in manually. You can create a forwarder so that it will actually forward any requests to their DNS servers. So that's quite interesting.
I'm doing something similar with one of the setups I'm doing at the minute. So I've got a question about that actually. Would that affect everybody on the domain, or can you specify it for certain users?
No, that'd be to everyone on the domain.
Right. Because it does everything.
So those are the forward lookup zones. So again, you've got your default one for your domain, and then you can add up any number ones you want on those. The other thing you can do on a DNS server is reverse lookup zones. Okay, reverse lookup zones is the other way around. So let's say you've got an IP address, and you wanted to know what that is. So let's say you've got some firewall rule or something, or you're monitoring the network and you can see a packet coming from 192.168.1.11 and you go, well, what is that? I don't know what the name of that is. So if you ping it, obviously it will come back with that you could ping it. But what you can do is you can set up reverse lookup signs. When you first create a domain, it will add in the local subnet. So if your local subnet is like 192.168.1, it will automatically generate that reverse lookup sign for you. But oddly, the way it records inside DNS is that it's actually backwards. So instead of not, you think it'd be 192.168.1 it display, it doesn't actually, it actually displays it 1.168.192. So it types it in backwards for you. And
okay. Okay, yeah.
So what you can do is that when the PC's on the domain and it's got DHCP set up, what you can set up is that when it gives its IP address on the domain, and it obviously then registers its name in DNS, so it'll say pc1.admin.local, it registers its domain, it registers IP address in the DNS server. So that when you ping pc1.admin.local, it'll come back with 192.168.1.11, okay? But also, when it registers itself, it also puts reverse DNS in. So it will put it in as... So it will add a record, and it will tell you. So when you do an NS lookup, which is like a command you can type, you type an NS lookup. It's a command line utility, and you can put NS lookup, click on return, and you can put your domain name, whatever domain name you want to look for.
Yeah.
It will return the IP address. Normally, it returns the default. It returns the A record, but you can set the server type so you can tell it to resolve MX records or change names or whatever, or C names, sorry. But what you can do is if you put NS lookup, click return, and put the IP address in, it will go and tell you what that IP address is. So you could then find out what name of that computer is. Sorry, what the IP address is. Yeah, so if you have an IP address, and you can then obviously then work out what the name of that that PC is. So you could obviously, if you've got a problem with that server's kind of, sorry, that PC's generating a load of bandwidth or whatever, you can then you can find that out.
So you can pinpoint that particular PC name.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, I've used NS lookup in the past. You've got to use that on the command line, haven't you? That's a command line tool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I have used it in the past, but I can't remember why.
Because what you can do is you can actually type ping minus A and the IP address, and it will come back with the DNS name as well, if it's registered in DNS, obviously. So,
okay, right.
A thing to remember is that if you create other subnets, so let's say you've got two offices and you've got 192.168.1 as your primary office, and then you've got 192.168.2 as your second office. You need to manually create that reverse lookup zone because it doesn't do it by default. So you have to create it up. So if you don't do that, they can't register themselves with reverse lookup. So whenever you create a new subnet of site, it's always good for a new office. It's always good to remember to create that reverse lookup zone. The other thing about doing that is that a lot of servers or server software uses reverse DNS lookup. So a lot of monitoring tools, like I know the HP SIM tool, which is basically monitoring the hardware of HP tools, it does an NS lookup, reverse lookup first to determine what the name of that device is. So if you do a scan of the network and look for any servers on your network or a printer to see so it can monitor it, it will try and do a reverse lookup of it first. So even if you've got an A record set up for that printer or server, it won't actually use that name. It won't print that name in the console. It won't show the name unless it can do a reverse lookup. So it's always good to have a reverse lookup set up for each computer or device on your network. Because even if you create a manual record in DNS, it will, there's a little tick box and it'll say create reverse lookup as well. So always remember to tick that box as well. Also, on the internet, you can do reverse lookup as well. You normally have to speak to your ISP to get that set, because it's always good. So if you ever get hacked or something, you can obviously look at the, you have no idea where this IP address, again, you can do a ping minus A, the IP address, and obviously it will return it back. So, yeah, we had a couple of issues a couple of weeks ago with one of our customers getting, like, bombarded by a remote IP, and we had to do a minus A, and it was coming from Germany, this IP address. If you did it, it was like it was coming from some random home ISP in Germany. So,
so NS lookup, if I remember rightly, doesn't that stand for name server lookup?
Yeah,
that's what it means, right? Yeah. So it is exactly as it says on the tin.
Yes,
it looks up the name servers. So, okay, how does that relate to like a whois lookup on the internet? How similar is that?
Well, whois lookup is just looks up what the details of the domain, so it'll tell you who owns that domain, who the technical contacts are, you. Whereas the NS lookup actually looks up the actual physical DNS records.
Okay, right. Which is what you're probably more interested in, especially if you had a problem with like that. So, okay. So,
so that's really all I've got to talk about DNS at the moment. I can't think about too much more of what I wanted to say about it. The other bit I wanted to talk about was regarding VPNs. We had an email in the other week, didn't we, about the guy who lives in France who is trying to tunnel his VPN traffic
back
into the UK. And then you were talking about the site-to-site, where we create the site-to-site VPN between the two sites, didn't we?
Yep, that's right.
So I wanted to go over a bit briefly. We won't go into too much detail today. We won't go deep dive, but I wanted to just go through what the different types. I think I classify, really, there's two types of VPN you can get: dial-in and site-to-site. So what is the difference? So dial-in is what I would class as that you want a remote user to get into the office so he can access his documents from home. So you want to set up a VPN so when he's at home he can click on an icon, it connects into the network, asks you for a username and password, and then it authenticates and then lets you on the network. So
that's kind of a temporary thing, isn't it, I suppose? That's for a short period of time.
Yeah, well, a lot of our customers do it for when they're working from home or when they're out of the office. All they want to do is click into the office, so that like they're in the office, and then they can go out.
Would that be for necessarily just for documents access or for remote desktop?
Anything. So it means they're that means they're on the network. So it means they're like they're being in the office and they can access whatever they need to access a server, emails, print, whatever they want to do. The other one is called site-to-site VPN. So you've got two offices like you had with the issue we had the other week, is that you have you've got two sites, but you want to connect them together so that you can share information. So it's like bringing up a virtual WAN between the two sites. So you've got Office 1 and Office 2. Using the internet, we create a connection between those two sites, kind of like a virtual tunnel. Well, that's what we haven't really said what VPN stands for, have we, really? Virtual private networks. That connects virtual private network between the two sites. So let's say you've got Site 1, Site 2, or Office 1, Office 2. The thing to remember is that Office 1 and Office 2 have got to be on separate IP addresses. So let's say Office 1's 192.168.2.x and the remote office is 192.168.3.x.
Yeah.
Okay. And then
that's how we do this as well. Yeah, that's right.
And then that means anything 192.168.2 can speak to anything 192.168.3.x. Notice that I didn't choose 192.168.1 there.
I did notice that, yeah.
Because
you use two and three.
The problem you've got is that dot one is what normal home users normally have, okay? And what you can get is that if your office IP address is 192.168.1 and your home IP address is 192.168.1, if you have a dial-in VPN, what you probably get is that when you connect to the office, your local PC will normally be given a 192.168.1 address as well. And your local machine's already got a 192.168.1 address. And it will get totally confused and it won't be able to communicate with the office.
Yeah.
So any office network I set up, I always choose something else and rather than 192.168.1 than that. So that's the site-to-site tunnel.
That's another reason for using the other 10 dot... What's the other one? 10
yeah,
dot
you can
zero.
Use 10.0.0. You've got the whole...
Because that's not even used very often home, is it? Because I was actually going to say, because you do have homes. I've seen a lot of 0.1s. 1.1 is the most common.
Yeah.
And there are some Belkin routers which are 2.1 as well by default.
So normally we have offices. We normally use a 10.0. Range something, but the problem you get is if you ever get two companies merged together, which has got 10 dot, it gets a bit confusing because always you can use 172.16.x.x.
Oh yeah, that's another one. Yeah.
So that's what we normally use for that. So that's basically what the VPN are. So you've got the dial-in VPN and you've got the site-to-site. There's different technologies you can get to get the actual VPN uses. You get PPTP, which is point-to-point tunnel protocol, I think, if I remember looking at my notes. Yeah, point-to-point tunneling protocol. It's very insecure, but it's easy to configure. You can easily set up it on a Windows server. You can set it up. It works nicely through a NAT firewall. All you have to do is forward the ports from the firewall. I think it's something like 1723. You have to fire and forward across between your firewall to your server. It's easy. Every Windows client has got that PTP built into it, so you haven't got to buy any software. You haven't got to have a Cisco VPN or anything in the IPsec client for work. And it's really easy to click, but it's very unsecure because it's easy crackable. But a lot of people still use it.
Does it just use simple passwords? Does it allow simple password?
No, it's not that. It's just the way that if you capture the packets between the two tunnels, you can easily decrypt what the password is.
Okay.
I don't think it uses much encryption to integrate by default. If you configure it, I don't think it actually authenticates. It doesn't actually encrypt the packets. It just literally it just opens the tunnel and passes the traffic through so people can see what you have it. The other one which is called IPsec tunnel, which is what you normally use for site-to-site tunnels. I won't go into details now. I'm going to go into details with that next time. You get phase one. It's basically the way it authenticates the two remote ends. So you can do things like you have to agree on a pre-shared key to authenticate, and also do things like it will check what the public IP address it's coming from, and it also negotiates the secure channel, like what the actual IKE phases are. Once that's been established, you get a phase two, which is actually where the data is actually then encrypted between the two sites. So it's a lot more secure, and you can even use things like certificates to authenticate. And then again, you can actually use IPsec for the remote dial-in users as well, we were calling it the dial-in VPN. So you can have it so that you have a pre-shared key, which everyone has, and you have to have some sort of client. It's not defaulted in Windows, but you obviously can get like this. There's still like a free one called like Shushoff, or you can get or if you've got a Cisco device or a Juniper device, is that you get a client. And what that does is that actually authenticates you using phase one, but it will then ask you for things like your username and password. And then you have a thing at the back end on your firewall called a Radius server, which basically will maybe authenticate with AD. So first of all, you have to have that policy file so you can get that IPsec connection up running. So you've got your pre-shared key. It will then say, right, yep, I can let you on, but what's your username and password? Then basically the Radius service will contact AD and say, yes, this person can then log on, okay. And then it says, yep, we can log on. And then you can get in, it gets phase two. A lot of these things you can use as well. Like, have you seen these hardware tokens you can get? Two-factor for authentication?
These RSA, I haven't.
RSA tokens. So it's like another security thing. So so even if someone steals your username and password, you have to have this third device. So it's like a little device, and it's got a number on it, and it changes every 60 seconds.
Oh, okay, so, yes. Yeah.
So even if they get your username and password, you still have to have this key. So, yeah, it's very good. So
this is like comparing WEP to WPA, isn't it, really?
Kind of thing, yeah. So there's a lot of things you can do on this. So with the old... what you can do with these... with the site-to-site VPNs and the dial-ins is a thing called split tunneling. So what you can do with your dial-in VPN is that you can set it so that depending on what your default gateway is. So if you connect to a VPN, okay, you can tell it to pass all your traffic down the VPN tunnel so that all your traffic goes down to the VPN tunnel. So all your internet traffic will then go down the tunnel and then go out on their the corporate network, which is quite good because you can obviously then filter what everyone's looking on. You can do a thing called a split tunnel where you only push certain traffic down that tunnel. So you could say any traffic to the office, which is 192.168.2 in our example, goes down that VPN tunnel, but any other local web traffic goes out your local internet connection, which is it's better in some ways because your internet means that you're going, if all the traffic's going down the VPN tunnel, means your internet's got to go all down the VPN tunnel and then back again. Whereas if you've got the split tunneling, it will obviously always go, your internet traffic will go straight onto the internet. That's a bit of a security risk, because if anyone manages to hack your PC while you're on the VPN, it means that people can have obviously then got access to your corporate network.
Yeah, I was going to say, actually, yeah, I mean, what are the... Say you've got two big network or two big offices, different locations, you use the internet to connect them together on one of these tunnels, then how does that affect bandwidth on each site?
You can limit on some firewalls what limit bandwidth you want to use, okay? But not normally, not a lot normally, I mean... With the technology you can get these over ADSL or FTTC, where you can obviously get like 10 meg connections, it works absolutely fine with the bandwidth. Yeah. The other way as well is that you can define what traffic goes down those VPNs. So going back to site to site, and going back to what the guy from France was saying, was that he was pushing all this traffic down the VPN tunnel. So the guy is in France, and he wants to watch BBC iPlayer in the UK, because obviously when he goes to get BBC iPlayer, it was saying, hang on a minute, you're in France. I know what your IP address, you're in France. But he had a mate with a Viagor in the UK, and he had a Viagor, and he got a VPN tunnel connected between the two. Okay. He then sent a tick box on the Viagors, which basically says force any traffic down this VPN tunnel. So you check the box that says change the default gateway to the remote end. And that's why that means that any traffic he leaves his network goes down that VPN tunnel to Britain, and then obviously he can then watch iPlayer because it knows how to get back again. So
okay.
Do you see what I mean on that kind of thing? Yeah. So So you can set up VPN traffic with the more bigger firewalls, with the Uniper and Cisco's. You can tell it what subnets you want to go down that tunnel. So you might have like a spoken kind of network where you've got more than one site. So let's say everything goes by the central server, but you want their local traffic to go out on the internet. So you can say, I want 192.168.2 and 192.168.3 to go down the main tunnel, but I want all the traffic. And the problem the guy had in France was saying that he had a wireless, so he had two networks, so he had two different subnets, and he wanted basically anyone on the Wi-Fi network. He was in a hotel or the guest Wi-Fi. Yeah. He wanted to go out on the normal internet, but because obviously we changed the default gateway to the VPN tunnel, all the traffic was going down that connection. So I did a bit of research. I don't know if you can actually do it on the model he's got, but you can do a thing called load balancing on the load balancing and routing on that Viagor, which means that what I would recommend you do is you untick the box what says send all the traffic to go down this VPN tunnel, but tell it, but when you want to send the and then create a rule that says any traffic from his internal LAN, so anything that says internal LAN 192.168.2, say anything from that traffic, force it down the VPN connection so that only the traffic on his local LAN will go down that VPN connection. Anything on the second subnet will then go out via the local internet connection. I don't know if his router is a model which can do it, but looking at some of the other models, like that one you had for your other site, the 2960, can definitely do those. So yeah. It's all basically just doing a bit of routing, basically, deciding what you can and can't do.
Okay. Yeah, I was wondering how you got on with him. You got in touch with him again, have you? And you've...
Well, I've kind of been going back and forth on emails. I don't think his router will do what we want it to do, because I think the only way you could be able to do it is doing it by some routing kind of thing. So, yeah, it's the only way I can think of doing it. So, yeah, a 2830 is what we normally use on our customer sites, and there's a section called load balancing. And you can say, like, if you've got from this subnet, send it down this VPN connection or this... anything to go to this, use this. So say you've got like a load balancing, you've got two ADSL connections on that one of Draytech, you can say anything from one subnet down this connection and anything from this subnet, mm-hmm. another subnet, go down the other connection. So,
and that's if you've got two ADSL connections.
Yeah. So yeah. There's a lot you can do with that load balancing, but the problem with that is the Viagors are really good, but they're very limiting when you're trying to start doing advanced stuff like that. That's when you think like the Microtix and the Cisco routers could come into their own, because you can script all that yourself. So okay. That's really all I want to talk about really this week on VPN devices. And it's been a bit of a mad week for me at work, so I didn't really get to do that much research what I wanted to do. So I think next time we'll definitely go into more detail about it.
It sounds like a mad week that you've had. Especially playing that 2048 game.
Yeah.
You must have been really busy.
Yeah. How far have you got so far?
I stopped doing it before. In fact, if you go back to the site after you're halfway through it, it remembers where you're up to.
All right.
So, it's good stuff for VPN, isn't it? Because it's a real must, especially with companies with more than one site, you know, it's the way you connect them together, isn't it? It's the way that you, from anywhere in the world, isn't it? They don't have to be local. They don't have to be next door to each. They could be anywhere, couldn't they?
Yeah.
And it's the same principle of, multinational big organizations. They all use the same methods, don't they, really?
Yeah.
To connect different sites up and different data centers and stuff like that. So there you go. So if we come up with any, or if anybody out there has any specific questions about VPN, or maybe they have their own issues that they want some assistance with sorting out, then they can send us an email, couldn't they? And tell us their story. We've had that one guy from France who wants to do the iPlayer one. So if anyone else has any VPN questions or DNS questions as well, then they can email in.
Good. All right. Well, if you want to get in contact with us, you can email us at mail@admin.podcast.co.uk, or you can email me at al@admin.podcast.co.uk, or you can email Andy@admin.podcast.co.uk. So everyone have a good week, and we'll see you all soon.
Yeah, we'll see you next week. See you soon. Bye now.